going to totally whine about it. So on the welcome to a new episode of Mentioned in Dispatches, where we finally hit record despite the fact that we've been chattering for several minutes. And tonight, Doug and Jim both stopped by. Hi, Doug.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Jim.
Hey, good evening.
Jim is lamenting, and the rest of us are sharing in his pain. So Jim, we've established before recording that nostalgia is in fact irrational. Explain to the listening audience at home about which you are currently being irrational. Note I said currently being irrational, because we got to limit it somehow.
And it does require me to admit certain things, and I do admit certain things in that we've gone through now several iterations. You know, I wrote the piece for the Armchair Dragoons about Marco Arnardo's stupid piece about why war games had to change or they would die, which I will give Bruce Garrick all credit. I thought my piece was irrational. He got cussy.
which doesn't happen often for Bruce.
it was actually astonishing. I was listening to his podcast, which is very good and people should listen to when they're done with ours. And he's usually got this really middle, you know, he's got strong opinions, but he's got this middle C tone. He suggested that Marco should have sex with himself.
in slightly more vulgar phrasing.
Yeah, and it was so on point. I was actually working out. The people in the gym gave me a look because I was going, yeah, you tell him, brother. So we've gone through that, and then we went through Mystery Wizard, and we've talked about that ad nauseum and about GMT's choices. And now the latest is Hasbro, whoever owns them now. I really have lost track. I assume it's still Wizards or Hasbro to Wizards to Avalon Hill.
I think so.
Is that the chain of custody? Are they? Is that who got the name in the divorce?
Yeah, I think so. But we're sitting down at the Magic Internet box here. Let's take a look. So. Go on with your ranting while I research.
What came up, it was actually Jeff Engelstein, a person I have a great deal of regard for, who thinks pretty deeply about games, who came out with and has designed his fair number of games. And he came out with just a little tweet where he posted an article that Hasbro had announced that Avalon Hill, or Wizards had announced, that Avalon Hill would be releasing I don't want to call it rethemed, but like a different version of Mystery at House on the Hill, featuring the cast of Scooby-Doo. Now, I observed first that this mod for Mystery on House on the Hill, or Escape from House on the Hill, I think it is. That's it. Escape from House on the Hill. Has existed on the tabletop simulator for months now. You know, people have already done this. So I thought that was interesting. But then I noticed, and Jeff's point was, I don't know how to feel about the fact that this is coming out from Avalon Hill.
Yeah, allow me to read you the opening line of Avalon Hill's Wikipedia entry. Avalon Hill Games, Inc. is a game company that specializes in war games and strategic board games.
Yeah. And so I actually tweeted back to Jeff, and he liked it. It was very gracious of him. But I tweeted back to him a picture of the John Hill's famous squad, you know, the Roger McGowan cover of Squad Leader. And I said, you know, if it's all the same to you, I'm going to be in my closet clutching this, sobbing softly to myself.
Yeah.
And then I thought about it more, and I just said, you know what? And you were mentioning this, Brian, your point's 100% correct. What in God's name do they imagine people... Well, first of all, who knows what Avalon Hill is?
Yeah.
Unless you're over 40.
Yeah, to me, there's two things wrong with this. I mean, look, there's a million things wrong with this. To me, there's two big things wrong with this. First of all, that you're using the Avalon Hill name on something that is completely non-Avalon Hill-ish for a bunch of... when your target market is not associating it with Avalon Hill at all. Like, the target market has no idea what Avalon Hill is supposed to be one way or the other, so why use that name, right? You could have named it Mulberry Hill Games Releases whatever, and nobody would have given a rip. Like, it doesn't matter to your target audience what the publisher name is. The flip side of it is, I'm curious how many of the people currently involved in the development or operations or running of that company have a clue what Avalon Hill is, or why it matters. And part of what I, you know, the part of what we got into it on Twitter about earlier is, you know, somebody was saying the guys, I think it was over at Meeple Mountain, the same guys that don't think the coin games were particularly influential over the last 10 years, that's a whole separate rant. The guys over at Meeple Mountain were like, well, you know, the Betrayal games are very popular and well thought out and well regarded games, all of which is absolutely true, and they're not war games. And that was Avalon Hill's bread and butter. Like, Avalon Hill didn't get famous for Lie, Cheat, and Steal. Avalon Hill got famous for Squad Leader, Panzer Blitz.
Wilderness Survival.
Huh?
Wilderness Survival.
Wilderness Survival consistently voted the worst game ever made.
Yeah. And you know, Avalon Hill got famous for Squad Leader and Panzer Blitz and Luftwaffe and Storm Over Arnhem and all of these other, you know, seminal war games that everybody had played and loved forever. There's a reason people are still playing Panzer Blitz today. And you know, are the Betrayal games going to stand the test of time? Well, maybe 50 years from now we'll be talking about it. But we know that 45, 50 years later now, today, people are still playing Panzer Blitz.
And didn't we just see, I think we're at the 50th, I think this is the 50th anniversary of Panzer Blitz.
I believe
And I believe I saw a Twitter stream of people who have gotten together at various groupings last weekend to play Panzer Blitz.
Yeah.
You know, so is that what's going to happen 50 years from now, from 80%, 90% of this pile of hobby games that's being laden onto us? I don't think so.
Yeah. Who knows?
Well, I can go down into the chest in the basement right now and pull out not just Panzer Blitz and Panzer Leader, but Alexander and Starship Troopers. And what do you want to play? I got them. They're here. Jim, you got them.
Yes, you do. Yes, I do. And they get played. And I always, every time somebody says Alexander, I point out Alexander by Avalon Hill, written by Gary Gygax.
Yeah.
To your point, Brent, who do you know what Avalon Hill is?
Yeah, these guys don't have a clue.
I want to be in a pitch meeting where they say, we're going to bust out this brand new shrink wrap for a slightly tweaked version of Escape from the House on the Hill. It's going to be Scooby-Doo, and it's going to be under our Avalon Hill imprint.
Yeah.
And if I'm in that room, fine. I'm not a boomer, but, you know, fine. Say, okay, boomer. Fine. Take the kid. Take the millennial. Ask her. Mm-hmm. What's Avalon Hill? What does that mean to you?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're to the point now where a non-trivial percentage of the board game playing audience wasn't even born when Avalon Hill went under. So, you know.
And then there's this other piece that gets under my skin with all this. It does go into this. Is this what we're left with? Is this what we're being reduced to as everybody pursues the hobby? Because I do believe now, and I'm not making predictions or anything, but I do believe the hobby game market is saturated. I think that, and I actually got asked an interesting question by the guys from Wargame HQ. They put out a Twitter question. Do you think that complexity is what prevents people from playing more games? That, you know, if the game release cycle was slower, people would buy more games. And I said, I actually think it's kind of the opposite. I think what prevents people from buying more games, in my case at least, is the fact that I got people asking me just to play one game and not all the games I'm buying.
Yeah.
You know, they're asking me to focus a little bit. But I think that there are a lot of games that are not being bought just because the supply is so profound. Even in, and this is a strange thing to say because I don't think it can last, but even in our little niche of war games, look, we've got money, but we don't have the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I have gone to miniatures. If you've been on the Armchair Dragoon Saturday Night Fights, you know that's what I play a lot of. But I'm still, you know, Kevin Zucker puts out a new game. Of course, I'm going to buy it. Don't be ridiculous.
But are you going to play it?
The new Austerlitz game that's coming out, a couple of things. I can't play them.
Yeah.
I've got no freaking time. None.
Well, because you're playing with minis on Saturday Night Fights.
Right. So I'm grinding through that. But it really is a situation where we are being surfeited with games, all these hobby games, and I'm beginning to see a possibility of a market correction. I really am. I don't know when it comes, I don't know when it'll come, but the fact that all of these companies, GMT certainly leading the pack, and now Avalon Hill and these others, they're all out there chasing the hobby dollar, that's a well-served market. And even Wargaming is incredibly well served at the moment. I'm curious. But no, I told my wife, I said to my wife, I said, you know, it's not rational. Of course it's their company. Come on. It's Avalon. I don't own it. And call it whatever they want. But there is a little piece of, like, it's a Hallmark Christmas story where you can't go home again. And you realize it just takes me back to those days when going down to my local hobby shop, because it wasn't even there was no such thing as a board game store. You're going down to your local hobby shop and looking up at the shelves at all the detergent boxes of SPI and Wilderness Survival and all the junk like Twixt and Feudal that they sold. But just looking forward to that next thing, and I realized that's the corner shelf
where they hid the D&D books, you know.
Right. Oh, yeah, no. And well, you know, that's obviously a whole other conversation. But remember that here in the good old American Middle West, there was a certain amount of ambivalence in 1981, 82 about carrying books with demons on the cover.
Yeah.
A certain amount?
And there were pamphlets and, what are you doing in there, son?
Oh, yes.
I guess what I'm saying is you can't go home again. I guess I know that. But I really do want to ask them, why you got to do this with Avalon Hill?
Yeah.
What's your, from a pure marketing and now from a business standpoint, let me be rational just for a second. I would like to ask the people responsible for Hasbro, what are you doing?
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to my point is that, you know, making a big deal out of the fact that it is Avalon Hill releasing this game, I don't think earns you any market cachet at all with anybody that you're expecting to buy this game. None of them know Avalon Hill from squat. So what's the point of slapping the Avalon Hill name on it? I mean, is this just a tax dodge because it's a separate ledger?
I would suggest that a lot of the people that are involved in this decision probably don't know that history either.
Oh, hell no.
You know, I'll bet the executive, the people who are at Avalon Hill, for the most part, have only the foggiest idea.
Yeah.
And in fact, I would suggest that a lot of the Hasbro and Avalon Hill people don't realize there are people still playing war games.
Oh, God, no.
Right? I mean,
that's probably a very good
point. That whole segment, they don't think we exist.
Well, so they probably think we exist up to the point of the Axis and Allies games, because those are still in their stable.
Right.
And they probably are the ones that think diplomacy is a war game.
Well, Risk is a war game.
Yeah, I have posited on podcasts in the past that I think Risk is the most pure war game out there. But again, you know, these guys don't know any better, and they don't understand why it's such a problem for folks like us. And folks like us are such a minority in the market that they can safely ignore us, and it will have zero impact on anything that they do.
Okay, let's, you know, I don't think I need to take a formal poll to say that the risk of any of the three of us owning the Scooby-Doo Escape from House on the Hill, it was pretty low.
You forget I have a 9-year-old daughter. It's not a non-zero chance. It's a low chance, but I wouldn't say it's a non-zero chance. I would say it's a non-zero chance.
Okay, so for Doug and I, it's zero. For you, it, at least we can see the meter wiggle.
Yes, it is still in the... in the low, you know, low decimal points, right? We're not even into whole numbers. but it is not zero. We're a little off topic for what we were intending to discuss tonight, but we started babbling about this and, you know, part of the point of these podcasts was what would it sound like if somebody was just eavesdropping on our conversations like this? So, you know, no reason not to hit record. I do want to ask this relatively provocative question, and then I'll probably cut the conversation short so we can get on to talking about Doug and Horse and Musket stuff. But you mentioned a market correction a few minutes ago, and we are all old enough to remember the early days of the hobby game business when pretty much every company was run by a bunch of gamers and fans who had zero business sense, right? My Great Dane has more business sense than 80% of the companies that existed before 1985. Okay. Sure. I mean, sure. We lived through these days. We lived through these days of, You know, and Jim, you and I did it going through old Dragon magazines, right? I mean, how many of the companies did we see in the ads in there that, like, that ad in Dragon was the apex of their existence?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Sure. Oh,
yeah. They scraped together their $500 to get themselves a 8th page ad on page 82 of the Dragon.
And it sold them an extra 4 copies of the game. You know, it's just, right. And so we've seen a ton of that. And now we come around to where board games, this is legit big business. And there's a reason that, like, not the entertainment pages of the New York Times, but the business pages of the New York Times are talking about the board game explosion and Kickstarter fueling the boom and everything. That clearly the bean counters have taken over certain parts of our hobby. And I'm wondering if we haven't overcorrected who is engaged in all of this, that the bean counters are out there saying, no, we got to crank out more product. We got to crank out more product. We got to strike while the iron's hot. We got to cash in on this craze. And they don't care about the field being littered with unplayed games behind them because they're busy cashing checks.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's classic business, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you see it again and again across many different fields. Yeah, I mean, go look at cell phone apps, right? I mean, and you get the long. What you're seeing is the long tail phenomenon of 80% of the revenues right now are being captured by 20% or less of the games.
Yeah,
and then there are all these other games. I mean, I've got a gentleman that I network with on a business basis every month. He works for a human resources company, and he and his wife have a game company, and they've released several games, and they've had respectable sales for the size company they are. Are they selling anything near like what this Betrayal on the House of the Hill Scooby-Doo version will sell? Probably not, but you know, they're making a living out of it.
Yeah.
Or an adjunct to their living out of it, which is all they really want to do. And that is one of the things that I think has dramatically changed. Brant, I am queuing you up for a major segue here.
Oh, boy.
but, you know, one of the things that's really changed because of on-demand printing and DTP games and the drop in production costs and computerized development of games and layout and all that stuff is that it's easier for people to get into this and produce stuff that they couldn't have really done. You know, they would have died.
Yeah.
In the 70s and 80s because the overhead was just so high.
Yeah.
Now they can keep doing it and they can produce stuff. And you know what? Maybe they produce a game a year and it's, they sell 200 copies of it. I mean, hell, let's look at, you know, even GMT, the giant of our hobby right now, if they sell 1,000 copies of one of their titles,
that's it's a instantly lot of in the reprint queue. You know?
Right. That's a
we
lot
got a hit.
It's, I mean, my God, for some of this stuff, it's the same 400 people buying it every single time.
Yeah.
I've mentioned Gene's appearance on Harold Buchanan's podcast before. And seriously, for anybody engaging in this conversation, you need to listen to it. Because no matter what I think about GMT, Gene himself said, oh, no. We almost lost everything in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
When we kind of were headed down the way that SPI went. And now what they do, and it shows in the product. It shows in the product, to Doug's point. He sits down with his guy, his number one guy, who's his right-hand man, who does he war games, he's a gamer, but he's ultimately his production guy.
Yeah.
And they sit down and to the, you know, really to the penny, figure out where they're at game by game, instance by instance. You know, we're almost out of Twilight Struggles. How many should we make?
Yeah.
But also with P500s, to Doug's point, with production dropping, with art being what it is, with also the ability to collaborate over vast distances now,
mm-hmm.
where you can have a designer in California working with an artist in New York or in Italy or in France, shipping information back and forth, doing correction. Shoot, you have a live meeting and do all those corrections on the fly, just like you're sitting in the next room.
Just like we're having a conversation about games.
Right.
Right, right. And with very sophisticated stuff. And at the end of it, you know how far you've... And then with a P500 built underneath it, which, as we've discussed, is really a P750, you know you will not lose money. You will not. It's only a question of how much money you're going to earn, how much extra.
Yeah.
And so they've built this model that is conservative. It is dollar-oriented, which I suppose every business should be. You know, to Doug's point, we are in an era where those lessons seem to have been learned. I do think there is still saturation. I think there are too many, but there are now safeguards built in. You do wonder, though. I love that. I had forgotten that usage, that long tail thing. I think there's a lot of people that see Car Wars making $660,000. And imagine themselves the next game and how far they're going to go. Absolutely. And how much success they're going to have.
And a lot of people are never going to get there. But the flip side of that is there's a whole bunch of people that will make enough to let them stay in the game.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think what's happening economically, and this isn't just gaming, it's across everything, right, is because of the communication technology, we can have micro groups. You can have niches that constitute a valuable, exploitable market. And for all the people who look at, you know, the Holland Spiels of the world and the other small game companies and go, well, that's a sign that this hobby is dying. Look, you know, you can never sell more than 400 copies. The world has changed. This is not a world anymore where in order to have a market, you have to sell 100,000 of something.
Yeah. Yeah. You can.
And it's very viable.
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest, so obviously we've mentioned the issue of production cost and production scaling. Has dramatically changed. Jim, you're right on the collaboration piece. That's absolutely made a huge difference. You're not just hanging
these
a sign up.
These are all big segues again, remember.
Here. Yes. but we're not just hanging signs up in hobby shops saying, hey, I need an artist, you know.
Well, yeah.
We can find them
where. At the same time, though, where are the damn hobby shops?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, we got a couple of them in Indy, but you'll be damned if you'll find a war game in one of them.
Well, I will freely admit to being spoiled. I've got the Gamer's Armory in my back door, in my backyard here. Like, I've got one of the best war game stores in the country, a 5-minute drive away.
You may have one of the only war game stores in the
Well, okay, fair. I mean, there's 40 or 50 of them spread out around the country, at least. I just happen to have a really good one, and yes, I fully admit that I'm spoiled by it.
But when I was Jim's age, when I was not Jim's age now, but when, you know, we was talking about earlier.
Yes.
I bought my Avalon Hill games in Throckmorton.
Yeah.
Throckmorton's was a hardware store that also had toys, and so they stock games.
Yes. I remember folks, so some folks have talked about having bought like a copy of Squad Leader on the shelf at their local drugstore. I remember seeing them on the shelves at KB Toys and Toys R Us.
And my whole point is that's never going to happen again, but
it doesn't need
to happen.
Yeah.
Because that was a time when you had this, you know, you had to sell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tens of thousands of copies to have a hope of making this work. That's not the case today.
No.
But what may be interesting about this, I think Jim's right. I think there is an enormous supply of games out there. My kids play a lot of the hobbyist games, and, you know, every time I see them, they bought some new thing that's got plastic parts and cards and, you know, it's as incomprehensible to me as my war games are to them. and they buy them almost at the same speed I buy war games. And discard them quickly. But you know, the thing is that you kind of got to be face-to-face to play a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
And right now we have a thing that's happening in the world that is maybe going to start scaring people from face-to-face interactions. And, if we see a drying up of the market, it may just be because something like a pandemic triggers people going, I'm going to stay at home.
Yeah, or you know, plug into YouTube and watch us do Saturday Night Fights.
Right, you know, and we do have those kind of technologies, but, you know.
Coronavirus is also having a delightful effect on the gaming industry right now. So.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Because right. Nothing's shipping out of China.
I've got two Kickstarters out there right now that are sending updates going, our factories are closed.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's still going to be somebody screaming about wanting their money back because of it.
Well, what are you talking about? It was the very next post.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I can't believe you delayed this game this much. I demand my money back. This is ridiculous.
Well.
It's like, guys, it's a worldwide, it could be a pandemic. You might want to relax.
Let's,
what you just brought up, the Kickstarter thing, is another piece of this. That's a funding mechanism that didn't exist before. You know, whether you're talking about Kickstarter, whether you're talking about P500, or whether you're talking about what Tom and Mary do at Holland Spiel, where it's all, you know, print on demand, basically. So they're never out the cost of inventory. The business models have also dramatically changed. In ways that we didn't have in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And that also fuels all of this. So, yeah, I'm not surprised, and I think it's great that we have a ton of stuff out there, both war games and other kinds of games. Will there be a correction? I think Jim's kind of right about that. I think particularly where we could see a correction amongst those big players. I don't know how much we would see it in the long tail, because I think the long tail has got enough resiliency built into it, because they just, you know, for the most part, it's not a bunch of people making,
yeah.
You know, that have a, you know.
Well, I'm talking about more of the people, because the first thing we've seen inside of hobby gaming has been massive levels of consolidation.
Right.
I don't know what Asmodee doesn't own right now. Right.
Well, Asmodee doesn't own themselves. That's one of the things. There's a venture capital firm behind them. And you know, at this point, we're off into a whole separate discussion. Doug has thrown us like three different on-ramps, and we keep blissfully yes. cruising down the highway without even tapping the brakes as we're trying to exit into the whole original topic for this call. So,
hey Brandt?
Yeah.
Hey, Brandt? You know what's a great little publisher that's a wonderful example of what we're talking about? Hollingfield.
Gee, you don't say.
I do. They're great. And you know what else? Doug has actually done some work for them that I think he'd love to talk about.
Amazing. No way. I wonder how that all worked out.
Crazy.
Astonishing.
So, the original point of this whole conversation was we were bringing Doug in to talk about the Horse and Musket series he's working on with the Hollenspiel guys. And we brought Jim along because, you know, if it involves stirrups and gunpowder, Jim has to be there. And so it's kind of like a rule. And
it's like it's in the desperate hope that, yes, it will arrive sometime in 1792.
Yeah.
You'll get there. You'll get there.
So, Doug, just so we're setting the correct information for the audience, you are not the designer of the Horse and Musket games. You are the developer on that series with Holland Spiel, correct?
That is correct, right. Sean Chick is the designer, and he has had some help on the latest module, Horse and Matchlock, from Johann Brotstrom, who is a decidedly not American fellow, who worked on that. It was the primary designer on that particular module along with Sean, but I'm the developer for the entire series.
So this series, so multiple games, any of them actually in print yet, or are these all still as of the recording here?
They're actually a number of them in print at this point. The original module is a game called Horse and Musket Dawn of an Era. And it has been out, oh gosh, a couple of years now. And that was actually done before I got involved. That was Sean's original concept of the game and sort of the kickoff of the entire series. And how I got involved, because I was really interested in playing it. I think it may have come out here. Let me go look cheat for just a second. I want to say about 2016, but I could be wrong. 2017.
Okay.
Subsequent to that, we put out two other volumes. So Dawn of an Era covers from 1680 to about 1720. Then we put out the volume two, which is... Hold on here a second. It covers basically up to the 1740s, and it is Sport of Kings, Volume 2. Volume 3 covers really the time around the Seven Years' War. It's out. It was released last year, I believe, and that was really kind of the first one that I was engaged in. And so lots of Frederick the Great and all that kind of good stuff going on there. And it is, I've just spaced the name of that too. See, I should have had my cheat sheets with me. and the other thing that we've started doing, and we put out one of these, last year, was, a set of annuals. So every year, we also put out a book. It's just a book. Doesn't have any counters or anything in it. It's just a scenario collection. So we put out Annual 1 last year. And Volume 3 is Crucible of War, by the way. And we're just about to put out Annual 2. I just finished the editing on it about 2 weeks ago, and Tom and Mary were doing layout and stuff, and it went to the publisher, Blue Panther, this week.
So, we've talked about it a little bit before, with you guys on the call, with the gunpowderists here on the call. What is it about the horse and musket era of games that gets you all jazzed up for wanting to work on these things?
This is as close as I am ever going to get to academia. I get to do the things that I really enjoy when I'm working on these games. Number one, I get to do a ton of research. I have a pretty strong library covering this period, and probably an academic quality library. And I'm really interested in the personalities, number one. There's some fascinating personalities during this time frame. I mean, I've thrown out some of the names already. Frederick the Great. Of course, we have Gustav Adolf. We have the Sun King, you know, himself, Louis. We have Turenne. We have Condé. We have even personalities that aren't as well known. Sir Francis Vere, for example, I'm doing a bunch of reading on right now. Who was just a war of independence. Much of what has turned into modern history has its roots in this period of time. The other thing about it that really fascinates me is just the evolution of what was going on here. Really, from this period up through the beginning of the 20th century, is a direct progression of technologies, technique, doctrine, thought processes, and there's a lot about it that we've written off, right? I mean, we're all familiar with the Hollywood movie that shows the stupid English in the American Revolution standing in lines while the Americans duck behind trees and shoot them to rags, and everybody thinks that's reality, when in fact it's not reality at all. That's not at all what happened. And, I mean, how many of us have heard time after time again, well, you know, how stupid, why did soldiers in this time stand in line? And there's very good reasons for it, that are driven by the technology of muskets and matchlocks and arquebuses and pikes instead of having bayonets. That very simple inventions had profound impacts on warfare. One of the things that drove the Prussians to be superior infantry during the Seven Years' War is that they had iron ramrods, and other people were still using wood. So they were able to load and fire more quickly. Real simple technology, but had a profound impact on their tactics.
Yeah. In the process of working through this, I don't want to get into any kind of state secrets here, so if we start to get into stuff you're not supposed to be sharing, that's fine, just tell us. But a lot of folks kind of understand what the designers do. They might have kind of an idea of what the developer does, sort of, you know, like sanding off a lot of the rough edges, making sure that the game actually flows the way it's supposed to, making sure you could pick up the rules and start from scratch and be able to play things all the way through instead of, you know, the designer having to stand over your shoulder going, well, what I meant to say was.
Right.
But when the designer has what he considers to be a sufficiently complete package to send over to you to start developing, what is it that you get in and what is it that goes out from you either back to the designer or off to the publisher?
Sure. So it's a little bit different with Quartz and Musket in that the core rules are already developed. You know, the system was designed, the rules were developed, there's a base module out, and every add-on that we produce is mostly scenarios along with some rule changes designed to better depict that portion of the era, right? So, you know, when we get to 1792, which is coming pretty soon, Jim, you know, we're going to have rules that better replicate a lot of the things about the Napoleonic armies, right? You know, how do we effectively simulate attack columns, for example, and provide benefits? And those are modifications to the existing rules. So what I will typically get is, number one, a Word document that is Sean's set of rule changes to the base system. It will include, it'll actually be a second document, which is all the scenarios. And we have a pretty specific, we've evolved a very specific scenario format and language at this point so that they're all very, very consistent and they all look the same and it's possible to easily design them. And one of the things that I'm responsible for is making sure that all the scenarios are plugged into that format. And then I'll get literally a pile of vassal saves.
Okay.
Are the games, right? I mean, there's the maps with all the scenarios laid out. And we've got some really good, David Fagland put together some really good vassal modules for us. And so we use those to do a lot of the game development and a lot of the play testing, obviously. So I'll have 20 vassal files. And what I'll do is I'll go through the first thing that I'll do. The very first thing that I'll do is I'll go through the scenarios, which typically have a big chunk of prose, which is the scenario description, historical background, that kind of thing, and then the actual scenario. And I go through and I actually take out all of the scenario descriptions and put those in a second document. And that immediately heads off to Tom and Mary because they're going to do a style pass. They want to make sure everything is stylistically the same. And that's a thing that goes into their bailiwick, so they deal with that. But then I'm going to go through and I'm going to literally go through every vassal file, save game that I have, look at the scenario, and compare the written setup with what's in the vassal file. Do we, in fact, have... You know, if it says that there is a line infantry unit in hex K5, is that in the vassal file, right? Does the vassal file reflect that same thing?
Which one's the authoritative source, the vassal file or the notes?
At that point, I will typically have to turn around. If there is a disagreement between those two things, I make a note, and then I follow up with the designer, who is usually Sean, but not always. In the case of the annuals, that's actually handled as a contest, and we may have as many as 20 different scenario designers, all putting their bit in.
You are not going any farther in this conversation unless you tell Brandt and the listeners the counter manifest story.
Oh,
yeah. Ruh-roh.
Oh,
when the story has its own name, it's usually a good one.
Yeah. So, one of the problems with this is when you're using vassal modules to do the design, and many of these scenario designers are designing their scenarios in Vassal because it's quick and it's easy, and you know they don't have to lay maps and stuff out. The problem is that there is no counter limit in Vassal, so it's entirely possible, and we definitely have seen this, where designers have plunked down 18 line infantry units of the color green, when in fact the actual physical game only has six. Equally, because this is a sandbox game, we haven't really talked about what the overall game is, but it is a sandbox game that uses terrain tiles. We've had situations where there's simply, somebody's put down more river tiles than we actually have, or more fortification tiles, or, whatever. The counter met. Go ahead.
I was just saying, pick them, whatever extra tile.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what it is. And because you can just sit there and vassal and bang this stuff out. And so we've had a couple of pretty interesting situations where, I'm looking at this, and what I've actually had to do, and I always do now, is I go get my copies of the game and physically set everything up with the actual counters, to be 100% certain that we really have those parts in the counter mix.
Sounds like a necessity.
Well, and a lot of times the designers aren't doing that, right? I mean, they're designers. They're putting something together pretty quickly, and it just isn't really hitting them that there aren't,
So
12 cavalry units of that particular color.
So as you're sort of fighting your way through all of this here, you've got, if you run into one of those cases where the designer's trying to put 12 cavalry units on the field, based on the design that he's put together, but there's only 8 of them on the counter sheet, obviously there's a mismatch. But then what happens when Doug is doing his research and says, oh damn, there actually were 12 cavalry units in that battle? Like, how do you juggle what's available on the counter sheet with what was actually present historically?
And a really good example of that was in this annual that we just did. We did one of the battles in it is Nordlingen, and in this particular case, we had some I had some questions that were history based, and we got, I talked to the designer who happened to be Johan. And one of the ways we get around that is, there's a couple of things that help here. Number one, there's a pretty high level of abstraction in Horse and Musket. It's kind of like Command and Colors in that in a lot of cases, it's you can't sit there and go, all right, this piece on the board corresponds directly to this regiment. I was playing Edgehill this weekend, for example, and the Royalist Cavalry, which historically is made up of probably close to a dozen regiments between the two sides, is represented by 4 counters. One counter on each side is on each flank is the front line, and one is the second line, and that's it, right? So we can consolidate. We can go, all right, you know, either these units were brigaded together, or this is representational of a line of troops. So we don't have to have the individual units exactly mapped out. The other thing we could do, and this is what happened in Nordlingen, is many times the troops in question, particularly in this era, are of multiple nationalities. They may all be fighting for one side, but the reality is, you know, the quote-unquote Swedish army at Nordlingen, I mean, Jim, who's in that army, right? It's some Swedes.
Oh yeah. I mean,
Germans.
Yeah.
Scots.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right? And we could reach into the counter mix and we can say, okay, well, you know, we've got two brigades of infantry that are actually Scottish. So use a different color. Use different counters for those, yeah. Right? Which actually can open up interesting possibilities in the scenario design, where, you know, you can have leaders for those particular contingents and assign leader values for them. So if the Scots were particularly good troops and they had a particularly good leader, then we'll give that leader a high ranking. But he may not be the army commander. He may be a subordinate. So he's got a leader ranking of 3, but the overall army commander was a major loser. And he's got a rating of 0 or 1. So, okay, tactically, that good leader exercises excellent local control, but the army as a whole has a problem. And we might not have had that opportunity if we were just sticking to a single color counter mix. So there's a lot where we go back and forth, where we're looking at, you know, what really was the situation here, and what's the best way in a sandbox kind of system to represent that.
So, you know, let's be honest, for many of the battles you're looking at, pretty much every side had some German somebody present, right?
In a lot of cases, yeah, that's very true.
I mean, pick yeah. An army, there's Germans in it.
Right. That's very true. Now, the reality is that are they German Catholics or German Protestants? Are they imperial or are they an army from one of the elector states?
Yeah.
You know, so
are they Bavarians, Prussians, Hessians, from the Saxony, from the Rhineland, Bavarian. From, yeah.
You know, Hanoverian troops are a really lovely shade of pink, actually. But, you know, so even when it's all Germans, it's multiple actual forces on the map.
Yeah, yeah. I think wargamers, because we know our history a little better than most, understand that the idea of German, like holding up the air quotes, means a lot of things for a lot of years before we got a consolidated Germany that's not mm-hmm. even 200 years old at this point. So,
well, and in this period, particularly when we go back to the Horse and Matchlock game, which came out at the end of last year, which covers really from the 30 Years' War and the English Civil War and a couple of other wars, so, you know, call it 1620s, you don't even have a lot of the other countries as coherent entities, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
there is no Italy.
Nope.
There is a France, but what we conceive of a France today had a number of satellite states around the periphery.
Yeah.
There's
not really a consolidated Netherlands.
Right. Well, no. In fact, a lot of the battles happen. We haven't done a lot of scenarios for this yet, but I'm doing some research on it right now. The 80 Years' War, there isn't a Netherlands. There's
yeah.
the Spanish Netherlands, you know, the southern part of which is a Habsburg possession, and the northern part, which is in rebellion.
Yeah.
And is known as the States General because the Dutch have not really united into a formal nation yet.
Yep. And then the Austrians are the Austrians, the Hungarians, the Czechs, the Croats, the Serbs, the whoever else is, right?
And depending, again, on how early in the period you are, they're actually the Empire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So you've got the Holy Roman Empire. By the time we get to Volume 3, Austria is Austria.
Yeah.
And there is a Holy Roman Empire, but everybody sort of snickers about it.
Yeah. which isn't particularly holy, is no longer in Rome and isn't big enough to really be an empire.
Correct. But they do produce the stunning general Charles of Lorraine, who is so bad that in this annual that we're putting out, he is we're doing the Battle of Prague, and he's the commanding general. He's the army commander of the Austrian army, and he's the brother of the Holy Roman Emperor, who is the husband of Maria Theresa, who is the Empress of Austria.
Yeah.
And he is such a non-entity that Mary came across him as she was doing the editing and said, "Oh God, not this guy again." Because he's really bad.
Yeah. And yet still ubiquitous.
Well, he's politically necessary.
Yeah. As you're working through as the developer, obviously there's a lot of details you're picking and poking at, and this is clearly not a hand wave sort of gig. This is very much down in the weeds. Do you have a war story you can share with us where you found something that was just totally off the wall nuts, and you kind of had to really not pump the brakes, but stand on the brakes to stop and fix something and get it right for when we as the audience actually open the shrink wrap and start playing the game?
Well, there's sort of an innumerable number of those.
I was looking for a particularly egregious story in there somewhere.
It's really common to have, you know, all sorts of bizarre things. And the thing that happens that probably surprises me the most, and I shouldn't be surprised at this, but it takes multiple passes when you're putting something like this together to really QC it.
Yeah.
You've got to look at it a lot of times, and you've got to have sufficient space between those times that you look at it that you're not just glossing over stuff, right? I mean, you look at – we all know from, you know, proofreading that you spend too much time looking at something and you miss errors. And the same thing happens with games, right? You think you've got everything, and you come back and look at it 3 or 4 days later, and you go, "Oh my gosh, how did I miss that?"
Yeah.
And we just, as I said, we got through with this annual, and I had spent the better part of a month going through and setting up every single scenario and playing at least a few turns to make sure that it really, really made it, right? And doing the editing, and I had two or three scenarios in particular where, I'll be honest, I wasn't really sure what the designer's intent was. I was like, look, this doesn't even match with the history. What is this guy smoking? Which, important lesson, a lot of times after you get the explanation, it does make sense.
Yeah.
They were just seeing it from a different perspective than you were. And once in a while they're not. But a particularly egregious one this time was actually my own scenario. I've got a scenario in this collection, and it covers Furbelen, which is – Jim, do you know what the Battle of Furbelen is?
I can't even say that I've heard of it.
So the Battle of Furbelen is actually the start of the Prussian military tradition.
All right.
It is a battle at the beginning of the extremely well-known Scanian War. So the Scanian War is a war that occurs in the late 1670s between primarily Denmark and Sweden. And it looked like the Elector of Brandenburg was going to kick in on the side of Denmark. So the Swedes, backed by the French, really wanted to kick Brandenburg out of the war early so they could put pressure on the Danes to just give up. And so they invade Brandenburg. The Elector of Brandenburg manages to pull a quick maneuver because, as is common in this time, because they don't have good logistics, the Swedish army was divided in two. And the Elector of Brandenburg attacks, seizes a town, and is between the two halves of the Swedish army, trapping one of, and From there, we get the Battle of Fehrbellen, where the Swedes have to retreat across a river, but the bridge is damaged, so they have to hold off the Brandenburgers long enough that they can get the bridge fixed. The Brandenburger army is composed entirely of cavalry, which is not the case for the Swedes. The Swedes have a number of infantry regiments, most of whom are, again, surprise, surprise, actually Germans.
Well, I got to ask a quick question about the army composed entirely of cavalry.
Yep.
How many dragoons?
A small number.
I mean, this is the armchair dragoons. We are required to point out where the dragoons are.
There are dragoons. There are two regiments of dragoons.
Huzzah!
Actual dragoons, because during this period, dragoons are mounted infantry.
Yep.
They're not cavalry. So these are real dragoons, and they are guarding some artillery that the Brandenburgers set up on a hill and use to plow bloody rows through the Danish, or the Swedish infantry regiments. At the end of the day, what happens is the Brandenburgers win. They outflank one end of the line and sort of roll it up and cause the Swedes to have to retreat, but the bridge has been fixed by this point, and the Swedes do manage to get their army away. So it's not a particularly strategically meaningful victory, but it's the Brandenburgers beating the feared Swedes. They actually win, and it gives the impetus to the beginning of the Brandenburger army, and that particular Brandenburger elector is the guy that becomes the king in Prussia, and that's where we get Prussia from. So that's my scenario, okay, is this sort of obscure little battle.
That sounds interesting. The when you said this was the start of the Prussian military tradition, I thought you were going to talk about tactical genius and strategic failure.
Well, no, but that would apply too. But so I did my scenario, and I turned it in, and of course, I developed my scenario in Vassal, and so I was setting it out and looking at it, and I made a few changes to it, and I went and edited my copy and sent it off the scenario book to Tom. And a couple weeks go by, and he sends me back a PDF of the completed annual. He's getting ready to send it to the printer, and he wants me to look over it real quick. And I literally was like, you know, on a weekend, getting ready to go out, and thought, well, you know, I'll just look at it real quick. And I start going through it, and I'm finding a couple typos here and there, and I think, well, I better spend a little bit more time at this. And I get to my own scenario, and when I have edited it, it edited the written description of the scenario. I've left out the entire second line of the cavalry for the Brandenburgers. The Brandenburg army is half the size it's supposed to be.
Oops.
Doesn't match what's in the Vassal file, but it's what would have gone to the printer. So my own scenario, right? It was originally correct. I made a small change, but ended up wiping out half of the army accidentally and not knowing it and sending it off. And if I hadn't taken that additional look a few days later, that scenario would have been completely broken.
So your word processor was, in fact, the most devastating weapon on the battlefield.
Correct. It eliminated half the Brandenburg army. But every time you touch one of these things, you know, what had triggered me in saying I need to take a deeper look was, you know, we, like everybody does, we recycle previous documents. And there were a couple of the scenarios in the annual that had incorrect titles because the correct scenario data had been pasted in, but Tom and Mary were sick while they were doing it, and they missed that they hadn't overwritten the title. It was correct in the original document that was sent to them, but when it went into the Word publishing document, or the Word, you know, went into the layout software that Mary uses, she hadn't updated the title. Every time you touch one of these things, you're trying to fix it, you can actually wreck it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that applies to so many things in life, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You and I have both worked on, you know, large corporate IT projects long enough to know that the fact that you're fixing one thing means something else somewhere is breaking. The question is, when will you find it?
I think the thing that's really been interesting to me about this, getting a game out the door in good shape, and Holland Spiel is, Tom and Mary are, and I agree with this philosophy, pretty definite that they really don't want to be issuing errata for their games. They want a game to go out right and not have to touch it again after it's out. They don't want to be issuing updates and errata to publish games. So there's a bit of pressure in the process to make sure it's right, you know, going out the first time. I'll be honest with you, I didn't think it was nearly as hard a thing to do as it turns out to be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hours. There's a lot of work in really looking at all the little stuff to make sure it's right. And game designers, I love them to death, but a lot of designers are not great on details. They're great on mechanics. They're great on concept. They have a vision of what they want their game and their scenario to do. And I'm not, just for those who may be listening, I'm not calling Sean Chick out on this. I'm talking about maybe the broader community here. Sean does a pretty good job of this. But there's a lot of complexity and detail that designers aren't necessarily good at. And it's really easy, unless somebody is really paying attention, that you can put a game out. And we've all seen them, right? We've seen the games that have come out that you picked them up and you go, wow, you know, there's a game in here somewhere, but this didn't cook long enough.
I've released at least one of those. So. you know how on Facebook you can report a photo and you can tag it with, I'm in this picture and I don't like it? This is the verbal equivalent of, I'm in this picture and I don't like it.
It is tough.
Oh, God, yes.
It is much harder than I thought it was. There's a lot more work involved in this than I thought there was. And it's much more time-consuming than I ever believed it to be. And certainly if you're talking about, you know, Horse and Musket, like I said, we've got some great advantages in that our maps, for example, you know, this is a sandbox game. The point of the system is to be a sandbox for the gunpowder era. So our maps are representational as opposed to being exact, right? Yeah. We're, you know, it's got hills in roughly the right place, roughly the right size. You know, there's a forest tile that kind of is in the right place. So if you end up with a map that sort of looks like the battlefield, you're doing good. Boy, you turn around and you're doing something like OSG's Library of Napoleonic Battles, where they're actually making sure that buildings on the map are in the right place. That's a, you know, that's a level of this stuff even beyond what we're doing. I can't imagine.
Well, what cracks me up about those is that for OSG putting those buildings in the right place, I think only about half the time are the buildings being in the right place actually relevant to what's happening on the map.
In the case of OSG, certainly some of that stuff is the case, but, you know, you're dealing with people that, if you're playing those games, you care.
But you say when you're dealing with those people, we have one of those people on this call.
No, I am those people, and
you're not the only one of those people.
Yeah, I know. Jim is those people too, and you know, guilty as charged. I walked the Brandywine battlefield about 3 years ago, and literally took pictures and sent emails to a game designer who had recently covered it, saying you need to fix your map. You have buildings in the wrong place.
Yeah. Yep. So, you know, you mentioned that this is harder and more detail-oriented and more time-consuming than you ever thought it was going to be. And so how many more of these have you signed up for at this point?
several. About four more, actually. Volume 4 will come out late spring, early summer. It is titled Tides of Revolution. Can we guess what era that might be covering?
We're getting close. We're getting very, very close. Very close.
Very close. The next one right after that, which will also be a 2020 release, is the aptly named Age of Napoleon.
There we go.
All right. Yeah.
Now so suddenly Jim perks up on the call again.
Yeah, that one's probably going to be late summer, early fall. That'll be a Q3, Q4. Then we will do one more after that, which is Sunset of an Era. And that will take us basically through the American Civil War and into the latter half of the 19th century.
At which point we start to lose some of the horses and some of the muskets. And
Yeah. I mean, we're getting into more mechanized war. Now, I won't swear that we won't see, the sort of the latest that I'm seeing Sunset of an Era go is covering Koningrats. We're not actually doing the Franco-Prussian War. But I won't swear that we won't sneak one of those in there. It might happen. I also won't swear that there won't be a module covering the Italian Wars in the late 1400s, early 1500s. So there might be... I might have signed up for another at least four of these, probably.
So you're telling us a lot of what there won't be. What will there be?
Well, like I said, there definitely will be the Revolutionary period, which Jim will cover the French Revolutionary Wars.
Sure.
So you'll get your Valmy.
All right.
Well, I say that, but actually now that I look at the list of scenarios that Sean's published, he doesn't have that in there. So maybe he's sneaking that in Age of Napoleon. We are getting a lot of stuff in the 1796 campaign.
Yeah.
So French, American and French Revolution, we are getting Age of Napoleon, and we are getting up through the American Civil War, definitely. And we'll see what happens from there. The good news is this is a really well-received series. There's a lot of people for a Hollandspiel game, for a game of this nature. It's selling a decent number of copies. There's a number of people who are following it. It's a popular game. You've got a lot of people who are really interested in playing it. So if there's demand, we might end up doing some other things. There'll certainly be at least another couple annuals as well.
You've mentioned it a few times just for folks that are interested in it, although, let's face it, people listening to us already know better. But Hollandspiel stuff, we're not finding those in retail stores. You're ordering those online from hollandspiel.com.
Correct.
You'd mentioned their print-on-demand outfit. So they're, when you place the order, the printing press starts, and a couple of days later, a game shows up in the mail.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And... they're good quality. They have nice maps. They have nice thick counters. In fact, their counters are some of the thickest counters that I've seen. You will not be corner clipping these, not unless you're using a bastard file or something.
Yeah. They're pretty thick.
The one thing I will warn people
hammer
about
and chisel.
Is yeah, exactly. And I think Jim's had this experience too, that because they are print on demand. They ship as soon as they come off the printer, and you can occasionally need to air them out for a couple of days before you can play them because they're fairly pungent with ink.
Yeah. So the last question that we've got for tonight is actually, Doug, not for you, it's for Jim. Jim, when are we going to see some horse and musket stuff on Saturday Night Fights?
Well, actually, we on the Saturday Night Fights have been doing an awful lot of horse and musket, but this particular branch, I have told Doug the standard offer is there. The problem is, and this is a frustration that I have, I had an apotheosis yesterday. I saw the very face of the digital god, small g, because this Italian fellow published for Tabletop Simulator 1809 Bavarians. and so I immediately went back, and I'm doing a Vagram set for Blucher. By the way, on a little side note, Ross has formally challenged the Armchair Dragoons to a intercontinental battle. So this will be Scotland v. America.
Right.
So That's going to be really cool when we can get that set up. I don't know, as I told him, I said, I don't know as I want to do Vagram because, you know, that's not a one evening sort of a thing.
No, no, it's not.
I've just finished the French and it's enormous, as you might expect.
Dude, you guys made Eggmule take a month.
We did. It was actually, you know, you figure we drifted a couple players in and out. We taught a lot of the rules. We fiddled about a little. But it's still, I won't lie, it was still probably 8 hours altogether.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a lot. But to the question of horse and musket, it's just a question of the availability of figures. And so as soon as horse and musket makes its way into the Napoleonic era, we will absolutely build up a big battle set. Using some of the same terrain features you've seen for Commands and Colors Napoleonics. They have similarities to each other and they have some strong differences. And I think it'll be interesting for people to be able to compare those. It's one of the, I guess, the curses of being the fan of Commands and Colors that I am. It's obviously sells more just because of the platform that GMT has.
Yeah.
But because it's on the GMT platform, and this is not the first time I've said this, the Epic expansion, which is the expansion everybody's wanted for Commands and Colors, is sitting in the queue behind a whole lot of other games.
Yeah, right.
And whereas Hollenspiel has the ability, because of its, you know, smaller footprint and print-on-demand module or model and those things, has the ability to put games to market much more rapidly and get them into the hands of eager gamers. So, no, I am definitely looking forward to building a bunch of very nice sets for horse and musket in the Napoleonic period. Look, I'm excited to. I've got the first game. I've not bought the expansion since, but definitely will be purchasing. And I guess folks should note that when the Napoleonic games come, are they going to be standalone? Or are you going to have the first one?
You'll have to have the base set.
Okay, so it's very,
yeah. It'll be an expansion. The Napoleonic game will be an expansion. It will have counters in it. It won't have the map. It'll have its own player aid card because we'll have to adjust values, right?
Yes.
It'll have its own rule book, but the rules will be the changes to the core rules as opposed to a completely standalone rule book.
That's going to be very interesting because obviously the Commands and Colors system has fantasy, it has medieval. Now it has its big medieval game. It's got, of course, the incredible panoply of ancients, another one of the big lacks on Tabletop Simulator, probably the biggest, honestly.
Yeah, it really is.
Although, you know, I can't be too overly upset that there aren't 30 years war, English Civil War guys, though
right,
I certainly
right.
wish there were. I can be astonished that there's so little there for ancients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if you look, when you look at what people have done for World War II, it really makes you jealous because there are some gorgeous models for that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, I mean, one of the challenges that Commands and Colors has, it sticks to a period, right? And so it stays in the Napoleonic era. The rule tweaks go to national characteristics. The Prussians have iron will. The Russians have their paper strength. The Tsar roll. The British have their, you know, they have individual national characteristics. And so when it goes from ancients to medieval, it really makes fundamental changes to the game.
Right.
You know, I don't know as I want to compare Battlecry because it's such a simple system. But, you know, even Memoir in its fully evolved form is a radically different game than Commands and Colors Napoleonics, that is ancients, that is battle lore. So they do all these things very differently, whereas Horse and Musket seems to be taking a much more interesting incremental approach, tweaking the same system, but which is to its benefit because it can stay within Black Powder.
Right, right, which is, you know, why we're going to end. You know, I think one of the big reasons, frankly, that Sean wants to stop and not do the Franco-Prussian War is the combination of the artillery, the French rifles, and the introduction of machine guns are probably fundamentally incompatible with the rule set. I think we have to make so many changes that it's a different game.
Yeah, I would think that at that point you're talking about a different strand of warfare that...
Right, right. You're starting to get into truly modern warfare. The formations don't necessarily change, but the technology has a bigger impact.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a subject for another podcast as to sort of what's the first modern war, and part of that comes into what are the characteristics by which you're defining modern. And so I guess that would be another 90-minute discussion for another night.
Sure.
We're running well over an hour at this point. Doug, go ahead. Last thought there, Doug.
That was it.
Yeah. So
we're
running well over an hour at this point. And, Adam and others have pointed out, look, it's a podcast. I can always hit pause and come back. Well, that's true. But at some point, like, the family needs us back in the main part of the house, right?
They do.
We've got other things we got
to
do.
I do want to say that it's going to be a race on Saturday Night Fights, which I encourage people to come out and watch. We've had some wonderful new guests lately. We'll be back on Saturday to play. But one of the things I think will be a race is I very much want to get Hollenspiel's terrific Westphalia to the table.
Yes.
The trick is you got to have six.
Yeah.
And exactly six.
Yeah, and I actually got into this with Tom online, and I love him. I mean, you'll say this about Tom. You're not going to meet a bigger truth teller in gaming.
He's right.
He's going to tell you the way the world is, whether you like it or not. And I just put up there, I say, can we please at least get a bot for Westphalia? And he said, nope, not going to happen, not interested, thanks.
Yeah, that's tough.
And I went, oh, okay, all right. Because I'd maybe given you money. And he went, nope, that's not what this game is. Didn't make it for that.
Yeah.
And it's a subject, obviously, that both Doug and I are into. And so hopefully that's going to – that might beat Horse and Musket, the Age of Napoleon, to the table by just a little bit. I will also note, because I did take a moment to learn about the battle that Doug was referring, that the Elector of Brandenburg, among the many stories of that battle, according to the article I'm reading here in German, appears to have been – cut out of an encircling ring of Swedish foes by what? His dragoons.
Yep.
Huzzah!
So there it is.
And probably not in armchairs.
You don't know.
They may have been.
It may have.
Very, very Baroque armchairs.
And we know for a fact, outlandish hats.
Indeed.
Well, yeah, that goes without saying. So, yeah. Cool. Well, look, guys, it's been fun. Thank you for joining us here on Mentioned in Dispatches. Saturday Night Fights, 7 o'clock Central, so 8 o'clock Eastern time. I have no idea what that is in Scottish time, but nobody cares. It's the Scots, right? It's overnight. what is that in Australia? Is that like 10 in the morning for the Aussies?
Yeah, it's like 10 in the morning.
Yeah. So,
and a couple of times that we've had our guy, Zardoz join us, he's always having his Sunday morning coffee when he's playing.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. It's usually a decent crowd playing and a decent crowd in the chat commenting along while you guys are playing. So it's a fun crew to sit there and watch and have the game on for a little while and join if you can. We've got a whole Saturday Night Fights little sub forum area over at the Armchair Dragoons that you're welcome to pop into and make requests or ask how to join and to be a part of the crowd. So Doug, thank you very much for, sort of letting us see behind the curtain in the development process on Horse and Musket. It's, some fascinating stories there, and thank you for taking the time.
Hey, happy to talk about it. I'm glad you guys gave us an opportunity to talk about the game.
Yeah, and
it's a big part of my life right now. So I'm,
bigger than you expected it to be.
Yeah, yeah, no, but I'm really, really enjoying it. In fact, I'm honestly, every time I think about the end of the series, I kind of dread it.
Yeah,
because I really do enjoy it.
And Jim, thank you for ranting about lost nostalgia of gaming.
Yeah, we are. It's weird because I don't want to get the reputation of the guy that only looks backwards, because I think there is a lot of wonderful things going on. But, I also have realized that my home probably does lie over in the world of little miniature toy soldiers.
Yeah. Well, and look, anybody that's paid any attention to the media that you and I have cranked out over the last like six, 7 years, whatever, understands that there is a certain point at which you and I are almost wind-up toys for this nostalgia thing, right? You just sort of crank us up and let us go, and we're going to gripe about how crap today has no reverence for what it existed years ago. And I mean, that's just sort of our thing, isn't it, at this point?
Yeah, Yeah, no, it's so funny. There's a wonderful thing. You talk about printing on demand. A guy by the name of John Curry runs a service out of England by which you can buy a print on demand all the old miniature war game rule books, all the old Featherstones, all the old Patty Griffiths. And I've got, I'm embarrassed to say how much money I've thrown at them, but I just got, in fact, I'm holding it in my hands right now, Charles Grant's Charge, which was one of the earliest war game rule books to really take it seriously. And first of all, and we should do a whole show on this, because I'm struck by how much it's influenced by the Kriegsspiel. It's clearly influenced by the Kriegsspiel.
Right.
And how much it's still a lot of fun. So that's coming. That will be coming to Saturday Night Fights, a good old-fashioned game of Charge.
Well, it's going to have to be discussed on another show, because we started saying goodbye like 6 minutes ago.
Right, good point. Well, this is one of those famous Irish goodbyes.
Yeah. All right. Guys, thanks. Audience, thanks. And we'll come back and join us next week for another episode of Mention and Dispatches.